Hello, America and the world beyond. This is Alton Brown, and you are listening to the Alton Browncast, a kind of weird kind of culinary podcast thing. But I mean, I'm not like going to cook or eat or anything, because that would be kind of creepy and would leave you out. So we're mostly going to talk, which is something that I don't know, maybe I do too much of. Anyway, we're coming to you from the very small and seemingly smaller every day padded room above my garage in Atlanta, Georgia. Today, we're going to kind of reviewing some news stories. We keep a very close watch on food news and food items in the media. So we'll be taking a look at those. We're going to answer your calls and deal with some questions that have come to us via the internet. And of course, as always, or at least until my friends run out, we're going to have an interview with another fascinating individual. And this time, it is going to be someone that I'm going to be really honest with you. I haven't met, but I've wanted to meet. Keith Schroeder of High Road Ice Cream. Now, if you're in Atlanta, Georgia, you live anywhere really in Georgia, you've probably encountered High Road Ice Cream. And if you have, you'll find that pretty soon you will do anything to get more of it. Knocking over a liquor store, you know, embezzling company funds, doesn't matter. You got to have more of this stuff. I would hazard to say this is the best. Well, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say it. They don't pay me to say this, but I'm pretty sure this is the best ice cream made in America right now. And I'm mostly having Keith on the show because I know he'll bring samples, and I think that would be nice. So we'll be getting to that shortly. Since we're going to have an ice cream centric guest today, I thought I'd throw in a couple of ice cream tidbit kind of things here and there. Actually, if anybody knows me and hangs around my office, you know I've got books, just piled books of food quotes, which means only about 5 books because there just aren't that many of them. But I actually do collect food quotes. And one of my favorite food quotes happens to be about ice cream. It was written by Ralph Waldo Emerson, of course, the American poet who lived a long time ago. Died in Concord, Massachusetts, I think in 1850. Yeah, I don't remember, but I've been to his gravestone. It's really pretty. Anyway, he said of ice cream, "We dare not trust our wit for making our house pleasant to our friends. So we buy ice cream." I would hang with him, because the truth is I'd rather have less talk, more ice cream. But that's just me. There were some important food stories that happened during the 4th of July holiday, so we kind of want to take a little look back. The top story, of course, from the 4th of July, food-related at least, Joey Chestnut, the competitive eater, broke the world hot dog record, hot dog eating record, by consuming 69 Nathan's hot dogs in 10 minutes. 69 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Now, personally, I can't watch this stuff. I know it's an American tradition, eating competitions, whether it's pie or hot dogs, whatever it is. I literally become ill when I watch people do this kind of thing. I don't know what it is. It's not that I've got some big like moral thing against it. I just find it really petrifyingly revolting, I think is the only way that I can put it. There's something about watching a human being eat that fast and eat that much that just, I don't know. I saw Cool Hand Luke when I was really young, you know, and the whole thing with the eggs really, I don't know, shocked me. And it seemed like such a strange and horrible thing to do. Anyway, so I can't watch this kind of stuff. And even looking at the photograph of Mr. Chestnut, I'm looking at a photograph actually from the Hollywood Reporter of all places. Why this is must have been a slow week in Hollywood for this to make it. But here's Mr. Chestnut with his fist up in the air and his mouth just, he's got bits and pieces of spit and you know, hot dog all like around his pie hole there. And it makes me kind of ill to look at it. Anyway, so good news there that he gets the 69 hot dogs down. What's interesting though is I'm reading more of this article. It was actually filed by Seth Abramovich. I guess is how you say his name at the Hollywood Reporter, but it's been all around the wire. It's a wire story. Was actually about the 5 things that a lot of people don't know about competitive eating. And these are interesting because I think that I don't know. It's just, I think there's a documentary in here somewhere. Maybe I'll get to make it. Because get this, kids, there is a federation. Okay. Just like there's the World Wrestling Federation and, you know, extreme fighting and, you know, mixed martial arts and stuff like that. There is indeed a federation called, okay, this sounds, there's got to be a belt buckle with this on it, right? It's called, get this, the International Federation of Competitive Eating, which is IFOCE. What do you, is that IFOS? IFOSE? I don't know what it is. But anyway, somebody dreamed this up in 1997 to, quote, unite the many eating competitions around the world. Do they have a clubhouse? Is there a, can I go someplace? And is there a gift shop that I could go to? Is there a Hall of Fame? Because certainly this Joey Chestnut guy would be in it. So anyway, there is an International Federation of Competitive Eating. And in fact, I'm going to go online in a minute and see if they've got a website. I'm sure they do. Anyway, so they're apparently responsible for setting, you know, the standards for this, quote, sport, end quote. I guess they sanction. So somebody's really kind of figured out how to make money out of shoving vast amounts of groceries down your pie hole. So that's kind of interesting. And they've got very, very strict rules. And actually, this particular article goes on to talk about some of the rules. The rules for eating contests apparently are relatively simple. The food has got to be weighed, unless it's by count, like a hot dog. Like if it's like pie, I guess they'd have to weigh the pies, but hot dogs maybe are standards. And I understand that the Nathan's hot dogs, you know, since it's a standardized size, then I guess they just go by the size. The food in question can be consumed in whatever way the competitor chooses. They can rip it up, they can chew it up, swallow it whole, whatever the heck they want to do. Water is permitted to help lubricate the movement of items down the throat. I guess other liquids might be okay. In a case of a food like a hot dog or a hamburger, you can eat them, the bread and the meat together, or you can separate them. So we see this is a very liberal sport as far as allowing for personal style. When the time is called, or, you know, when the time is up, if there is still food in the contestant's mouth, it counts. So long as they are actually able to chew it and swallow it. So as long as it gets into your pie hole, it counts. But you still got to choke it down, even after the bell is rung. And I guess that's why this picture of Mr. Chestnut shows his, you know, his cheeks bulging out, because obviously he's still got a pretty big, serious load there in his gullet, so to speak. Now, here's an interesting one. This is about vomiting. Okay, there's some very, very strict rules set forth by IFOCE or whatever, the International Federation of Competitive Eating. They're very, very big rules about vomiting. Okay, and that is, and what's funny is that they call this, and I'm trying to find the source for this, but they refer to vomiting in this trade as, quote, a Roman incident. That's Roman as in someone from Rome. A Roman incident. So I guess the whole thing is you don't want to suffer a Roman incident. And we're going to get on that and try to find out where that comes from. But right now I can't seem to find it. So they cannot, if you vomit during the competition, it seems like that's not necessarily not vomit. If you have a Roman incident sometime during the competition, you're only disqualified if the regurgitated stuff touches the plate or the table. Well, that's a comfort, isn't it? What I don't get, though, is, well, do you have to, you know, re-eat it? I mean, if I ate, like, let's say 30 moon pies, and I'm not saying that I could eat 30 moon pies, but let's say I do eat 30 moon pies, but my goal is to eat 35. If I puke at 30, well, then obviously I've got plenty of room to eat, you know, another, you know, another 5 or 10 or whatever the number was. The point is, I don't understand why she get to puke at all. I mean, if you can't keep it down, you can't keep it down. And puking, so puking shouldn't be allowed at all. So I'm calling hoax on this whole thing. This is bogus, actually. I'm saying that this is bogus because if you puke, you should be out. And if I was to start a sister or a competing, if I were to start a competing federation to go up against the International Federation of Competitive Eating, and I'm thinking about it, I would say no vomiting allowed. You're out. You puke, you're out. You're done. Disgusting, disgusting business, and now obviously very dangerous to boot. So we now come to the part of the Alton Brown cast where we stun and amaze with another insightful interview. We do not set out to make people cry, but if it happens, you know, it happens. Sometimes that kind of cathartic thing takes place. So today we're talking to an Atlanta guy. I'm in Atlanta. He's in Atlanta. That makes sense. And this is Keith Schroeder from... do you actually say, when you say the name of your company, do you like to say High Road Ice Cream or is it High Road Ice Cream Company?
High Road Ice Cream.
Yeah. So if you are lucky enough to live in... Well, actually, how far away can you get your product now?
As far west as Las Vegas, soon to be Northern California, and I'm departing for Thailand to open a plant in Bangkok.
You're opening a plant. You decided that... Okay, let me get this straight. So anybody that's kind of into food in Atlanta knows your product.
Correct.
In the last couple of years, you guys have really kind of changed certainly the ice cream scene. Not that there was one really here, but you've made an ice cream scene here in Atlanta. You started with primarily aiming towards chefs and restaurants, which was an interesting way to go.
Correct.
Right. And why'd you do that?
I was a chef prior, and so it was just an audience that I think needed a product. In hotels, primarily, pastry chefs were kind of a thing of the past, right? You would go into pastry kitchens, and there were stacks of toilet paper and cleaning supplies where there used to be pastry chefs. And
yeah, you filled a real vacuum, which was that people, you know, food programs at nice hotels wanted to have an exclusive product, wanted a quality product, and they didn't have one because they couldn't make it anymore.
They couldn't make it
anymore.
There's
nobody there to do it.
That's right.
So you basically became the ice cream maker to the hotelier, so to speak.
Correct. And no one was doing custom. So, you know, it was something that people could call and say, I need something with rhubarb. Okay, great. And we'd have a conversation and we do it.
So you've gone from one plant, mm-hmm. I mean, barely call it a plant, a small
room.
Plant. Okay, a room. There, we've got it set. You had a room where you were cranking out. What, you guys were doing like 600 gallons a week or something like that?
I mean,
that's boutique as boutique gets.
That's right.
And now you tell me you're going off to Bangkok to open a plant. How exactly does that happen? Because typically there would be a few steps in between the room and the plant on the other side of the planet.
Right. So once we got to 600 gallons a day, we consider ourselves monsters of the industry.
you're knocking on Breyer's door right there, aren't you?
I had the gentleman from Mayfield Ice Cream say, we spill more in a day than you make.
Yeah.
To which I said, you should spill less.
Yeah, perhaps you should work on your shrinkage, big guy.
So when I was in grad school, we met some folks from Thailand in Lincoln, Nebraska. This story gets crazy.
Yeah, this is when you were at Kennesaw State,
just
up the road. Okay.
So we were doing some business planning competitions, and we met these gentlemen from Bangkok. And they were smitten with our story and our plan. And we had been, we'd befriended them. And I started traveling back and forth to Southeast Asia. They were traveling back here. We were making product. We were testing the market. This one guy was getting his PhD in disruptive innovation over there.
Disruptive
Isn't
innovation.
That great?
Oh, I like that very much. I got to write that down. Disruptive. I want to get a degree in disruptive innovation. Go ahead.
So this gentleman says, you have a disruptive brand. And I said, okay, I believe you. I don't know what it means, but I believe you.
I believe you and I want it.
Right. Sounds great. Sounds exciting. So we went to Bangkok and I traveled around and we sampled hotels and restaurants. Then we went to Singapore. And in fact, people over there are more excited about High Road than folks. Ice cream is normal. It's every day here in the U.S. It's hard to convince people that we're elevating it to a new level. Over there, it's just instantly exciting. You say bourbon burnt sugar over there. Oh, bourbon burnt sugar. Very exciting. And
never had bourbon, but it sounds fantastic.
So it's strangely enough, it's an easier sell over there.
Let's move away from business for a second and actually just talk about ice cream.
Yeah.
Why in the world would you think that in a marketplace that's already pretty much covered up, saturated with, quote, boutique, end quote, ice creams, do you decide to do it? Why?
I love the product with this visceral passion that can't be discussed in just a few minutes. The nerd factor of ice cream is so high and so elevated, and the scientific nuances of the product were such that I truly believed that even if I didn't make the best product in the first year or two of being in the ice cream business that eventually I would wear folks out in terms of our interest in trying to perfect the product. And I think there are a lot of folks out there who are focused on flavors and flavor trends, but we break it down all the way to its elements. We work a lot with freezing point depression, the balance of the ice cream mix, in a way that I think even the food scientists at companies like Unilever who are working on the Ben & Jerry's brand, they're cost engineering quality out of the product, where we're trying to engineer quality into the product. And it is simply our quest to just be the best of the best of the best on the planet. And we figure if we keep our eye on that, even more so than brand, then the brand will just emerge. So I got into the hotel world after teaching at New England Culinary Institute and was executive chef of fairly large properties. And I would find in times of stress or pressure when I needed to get away from the team, I would go build my little ice cream lab wherever I worked, and I would go just put my head down, and that was my catharsis.
Okay, tell me about your ice cream lab.
Okay, so it was a Musolello machine, the little countertop, beautiful 1 liter, yep. Right?
Little Italian
gorgeous
model.
Machine, yep. Yep. KitchenAid, access to dry ice so I could play with stuff. The best of the best, I would make little tinctures, think a great mixologist, bartender, tinctures and bottles and droppers. And then all the best of the best chocolates all racked and stacked in little Cambro containers and induction burner. Whisks, stainless steel bowls, ice cream mixes aged and in the cooler, yogurts, Greek yogurts, buttermilk, all that stuff to try to really knock out of the park. Incredible product.
But it was for you.
Oh, complete and utter waste of cash on behalf of the poor hotel companies you're that I
worked
for.
You were spending some corporation's money just so you could get your fix.
Confession.
I think that's the best way to do R&D, don't you? But at what point you were like, okay, this is actually R&D. This is no longer me playing with ice cream.
About three and a half, four years ago, where the ice cream actually was funny. 50 Cent came into the Westin here in Atlanta. Okay. And so someone said, chef, go get them your ice cream. They want ice cream. Give them your ice cream. So I did a huge, I must have had 30 flavors in. So I just did a bunch of small ramekins with this huge rainbow of flavors. And we sent the product out to these LA guys, and they're all
these
tasting
rappers.
The product. A room full of rappers in a private dining room in a business hotel. And they flipped over the product. And I thought, you know, okay, they're not the food aficionados of the century, but these guys are out and about eating on a regular basis.
And they've got cash to spend.
Hey, right? So it boosted my confidence to the point that I was in grad school at the time, and this business plan started to emerge based on, you know, the constant feedback of this is a little bit better than we've had before.
I have to argue that I think it's a whole lot better. The trend in the super premiums, we'll call them ice creams, is make it sweet and make it incredibly rich.
Yes.
Fatty and sweet. Because, of course, the more fat you put in, the more sweet you put in, the more difficult the formula is, right? Because you're dealing with things that don't naturally like to freeze. Mm-hmm. What you don't tend to see is subtlety and diversity in flavor combinations. As a professional chef and as someone who's been professionally trained myself, we talk a lot about seasoning. Mm-hmm. You know, when you cook a piece of meat or you cook a risotto, whatever it is, you talk about seasoning, getting the seasoning right. And people, civilians don't realize that what we're usually talking about is first and foremost salt.
Yes.
And then kind of everything else that comes into a balance. And as I was eating your ice creams, I realized these have been designed by a savory guy, not because they're savory, but because they're balanced and they're seasoned properly. And not just because you put fleur de sel in your vanilla ice cream. Okay. I mean, I can put that on there if I want to, but even your sorbets show a very succinct balance of flavor, which allows their complexity to come through without having to turn the volume up. Do you think that is something that other people are noticing and is why your product is as popular as it is?
I think so. And I think it appeals not to the broad market, but to a real, to someone who knows better, who's dined out, who has experienced food on that hyper-focused level. Like for the sorbets, for instance, it's not uncommon for us to use various kinds of bitters or a couple of different kinds of salts. Or Campari is always a trick up our sleeve in that product, because what it does, it helps. Sometimes you can't even tell that the Campari is in it, but what it does is it brings the fruit back to tasting like the fruit.
Instead of like sugar.
So if you go, the rough ratio for a sorbet is a third fruit, a third water, a third sweetener sugar of some sort. We make our own invert syrup in-house. If you try to spin
now,
just that.
Take a second and explain what an invert sugar is and why you use it.
Sure.
For those that don't know.
So the invert sugar, number one, actually boosts the sweetness of the invert. So let's say that sucrose would be 100% sweet. Invert sugar would be about 170 sweet. So we could use a little bit less of it. It definitely contributes to texture and prevents crystallization in the final product. So there are a number of reasons to make the invert.
You get the smoothness without necessarily making it all so sweet that you can't stand it.
That's exactly right. And so that balance, if you mix the fruit and the water and the invert sugar, will taste a lot like a Jolly Rancher, even if you use fantastic fruit. Right?
Hey, what's wrong with that? We'll give you some Jolly Rancher ice cream around here.
But then you have to bring it back to tasting like the fruit and things like salt and Campari and lime and zest. And sometimes we'll tear up citrus and leave the pith inside so it has some of that bitter nuance. You know, folks will say, well, don't use any of that bitter pith. Well, we want that white or the watermelon rind to whack up and chop up some of the white and let it steep in there for a while. So there's a lot going on. I think I'm a big believer in the book, The Elements of Taste by Kunz and Kaminsky, that I thought was didn't sell as much as it should have, but what a brilliant book. And the fact that they talk about bitter as a punctuation to everything that you eat, I think is critical. And it's something that I teach all the guys who work for me.
On top of the fact that we're hardwired to taste it, you know, we have very acute chemical senses for bitterness in our mouth. And if you can pluck those harp strings correctly, that's pretty powerful stuff. Let's talk for a second about flavor development. I'm really interested in how people that do what you do, whether it's ice cream, whether it's chocolate, whatever product it is, how their minds work from a flavor standpoint. Could you take me through the development of a flavor?
Oftentimes, we're trying to either express an ingredient in the best way we possibly can, a la our vanilla fleur de sel. So we'll make what seems like a classic version of a product. Let's make a good vanilla ice cream. And then let's eat it until we're bored with it and talk about what would make that vanilla more quintessential, as you suggest earlier. And with the vanilla, it was simply, okay, I think we've selected the right blend of vanillas. So now it's got some aromatic harmony to it, and it really does need that punch of salt, like a great chocolate chip cookie without the salt
is dead. It's
awful.
Dead. It's horrible.
Right?
Yeah,
so I think that there are a lot of ice creams on the market that fall flat because of their lack of focus on salt. Now, oftentimes at work, you know, it focuses on a destination, somewhere I've been, and want to evoke or bring that flavor back out. And the flavor that comes to mind is the mango chili lime sorbet that has become so popular for us.
Do you think this stuff is significantly soft?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have some ice cream. I got to get over to the spoons. I bet you get tired of eating ice cream.
Never.
Good. That was a trick question that I asked you. There you go. Have some spoons. People at home, never sample serious ice cream on a metal spoon. It kills your face. So we're using those little wooden paddles from the ice cream shop. What did you bring today?
Okay, so we've got a couple R&D products. One is a raspberry rhubarb, which I thought you would enjoy.
For rhubarb. I adore
the
rhubarb.
The other is our, I dare call it a flagship ice cream.
That's the bourbon, right?
Made at 2 a.m. under duress, but became an instant semi-classic. And then a brown butter praline. I brought our vanilla fleur de sel.
Which I could eat by the pint.
And this is one I'm pretty proud of. It's a new sorbet called hibiscus ginger, made with fresh pressed ginger.
All right, I'm thinking that I'm gonna start with the R&D one then, because I don't want to let the rhubarb get covered up. That's a strawberry rhubarb pie, including the crust. How do you do that? I can actually get that buttery. It's like the crust. How'd you do that? Is that magic? Demons? Is there a demon in there?
No. So malt and salt can mimic the presence of bread, crust, that kind of thing.
And caramelization.
That's right.
Malt.
So you want the flavor of Maillard, take a little malt powder, put it in the oven.
Because I don't taste malt.
Right.
No, I just taste pie. Is that going to hit the market? Because it should.
Yes.
malt and salt together can make the pie flavor. Where'd you learn that?
Just playing.
Just playing?
That's it.
So, how much of what you do is just from playing, and how much of it's from, like, study?
Well, I mean, I'm a food nerd by nature.
By
birth. But it's so much experimentation. I mean, but I'm really just bridging things I did as a chef to the pint.
No, I got to tell you, I know why the bourbon brown sugar is as popular as it is. Has anybody just plopped this into a big glass of Maker's Mark and called it a day?
Absolutely.
Because that's what I want to do.
It's a nice flavor, right? So this
I usually have bourbon up here in the studio, but I went to get some last night and the bottle was empty, so I'm not going to get that today.
That has Muddy Pond sorghum as a big part of the depth. Madagascar bourbon vanilla, a good bit of salt to that, and then the bourbon, and then we torch some sugar before adding it to the mix.
What made you think sorghum on that? Why go there?
I think sorghum against the bourbon. I was tasting sweeteners, different sweeteners in, mm-hmm. in whiskeys. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing, you know, the Scotch whiskey and the Canadian whiskey and mm-hmm. bourbon and maple and molasses and brown sugar and torch sugar and Demerara sugar, and the Maker's Mark with sorghum was something I wanted to consume in liquid form.
All right. I have some hibiscus ginger. Now, I have found, just as an ice cream maker and an enthusiast, sorbets are tough.
They
because
are.
Because you're playing a much, you know, you don't have fat to adjust texture.
That's
so
right.
How do you conquer this without getting a big old mouthful of crunchy?
So we use a refractometer for
this. And everybody at home's got one now.
Of course.
I mean, that's pretty much an everyday kind of kitchen tool, I'm sure. Multitasker.
So we use a refractometer to measure the sugars, and things will work anywhere from 28 to 32 mm-hmm. bricks.
Bricks. That's bricks with an X, everybody.
Once you start working with alcohol, the bet is off on that product. The other big challenge with sorbets is the amount of soluble fiber in
the fruit.
Whatever fruit is, because that soluble fiber will give you a false sugar reading on the refractometer, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because what the refractometer is measuring is dissolved solids, not necessarily just sugar.
Right.
And so
it's looking for kind of a size of molecule, if you will.
That's
and
exactly
oligosaccharide
right.
certainly is mimicked in soluble fibers, right?
Right. And so that's a range. And what you see a lot of pastry chefs doing is playing with some of the molecular gastronomy tools like xanthan and you know,
carrageenan,
using
and blah, 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 blah.
All that stuff. Milk powder mm-hmm. is a nice addition to something like that. Buttermilk powder is a nice addition. You know, folks often say, well, the second you add dairy, is it not a sorbet anymore? And I say, I don't see it that way.
No.
I see it as a sorbet is based on simple syrup conceptually, right? Mm-hmm. Plus something water-based.
Right.
Whereas ice cream is based on an ice cream mix.
All right, so we've got two more left here. We've got the vanilla fleur de sel. I want to finish with that
yeah.
one because it's such a favorite. So now let's this is so frosted over. I'm sorry that people I'm not really sorry because I don't want to share this. This is the brown butter praline, which is another way of saying butter pecan, right?
That's right.
I mean, in essence, I grew up, this is my favorite ice cream. Well, maybe mint chip was, but this is pretty close. Let's see how this goes. That's lovely. Which of these is your favorite? I'm just curious.
Of the batch, I'm partial to the bourbon burnt
sugar.
I think it's a really great, you know, for chefs, we called it the new vanilla, you know,
because it goes with everything.
It really does.
All right. I'm going to have some of the fleur de sel vanilla now, and I may break my spoon because this stuff's, I don't want to say that's the best vanilla ice cream I ever had, but I'm pretty sure it is. Yep. That's the best vanilla ice cream I ever had. It's better than my vanilla ice cream. I hate saying that. You put real thought into what kind of vanilla you're using. Is that all Madagascar?
It is.
Because I thought I could taste a little Tahitian in there as well.
It's all Madagascar, but it's some bean and some paste.
Here, there's some paper towels on the floor. We're making a mess here on the interview desk. The salt is so perfectly balanced in there. I think that, if I may state, one of the big problems with ice cream in this country from a homemaker perspective mm-hmm. is that we've gotten away from the hand churn. And I'm a big believer in the hand churn because you can't get the texture right, I don't believe, on a homemade ice cream. There are two ways to get it just right for me. One, you're using the hand churn because when you start to really feel tension, pressure, as that product starts to solidify, you speed up.
That's right.
You actually speed up the beaters, the dasher so that you get that air working into that, because it can't really take air until that time. And you can do that with like a home Cuisinart machine or something, because they tend to slow down as the mixture thickens. The only other way I've been able to get around it, and it's something that we do here a lot in the summer, is I've always got liquid nitrogen around. So, you know, we will make a la menu ice creams in the KitchenAid, you know, using that. And that's because the crystal size is so small, tend to not have the kind of textural problems that you do in other homemade ice creams. But do you find that the people have different expectations of what a great ice cream is now, because we don't make great ice cream at home anymore?
I do. I think that there are some ways to make ice cream at home that I think a commercial maker wouldn't employ, but mm-hmm. things like sweetened condensed milk can help things along.
Can you just give me a for instance of what problem does a little condensed milk solve?
Okay, so a lot of home mixes don't include milk solids, and solids are such a critical component to ice cream making.
Why?
Because they help to provide body, and they absorb some of the residual water in the mix. And so these solids hydrate, and they've got lactose in there. Essentially, it's the milk powder is lactose and protein, yep. and that's it. And it does contribute to the final body of the ice cream. So using sweetened condensed milk has these condensed milk solids throughout. And then the sugar that's in there, I believe, and I don't know, but I want to talk to a food scientist about it. I think that sugar inverts because it doesn't recrystallize. So that inverts sugar.
That would be my experience as well.
Right?
Yep, because I work with that stuff a good bit.
So putting that in there is going to help with a final texture. And the other thing is home ice cream formulas should, because of the lack of sophisticated equipment, have a little bit of a higher sugar content. And if you don't want a higher sweetener content, what you can do is buy some dextrose. And dextrose
old candy making a tool.
There you go. And so a little bit of dextrose, let's say your ice cream recipe called for a cup of milk, a cup of cream, 4 egg yolks, and you know, a half a cup of sugar.
Which is about as standard as you can get.
Right. Yeah. Take that half of that milk and make it sweetened condensed milk, mm-hmm. right? And take half of your sugar and make it dextrose instead of sugar. And I think what you have is something that's going to be a little bit more tolerant in your home freezer. The other important part of making...
When you say tolerant, you mean as far as is going to be able to texturally survive the fact that you're storing it in a box that's open and closed a bunch, that's usually right around zero?
Well, partially, but your home freezer won't freeze the product fast enough. The way that we get the ice cream to the point that it needs to be is by putting in very sophisticated hardening cabinets that get down to minus 50 Fahrenheit.
Sure, blast chillers, so using air impingement and right. getting it down very quickly.
So the way to do that at home is to, rather than putting your finished ice cream in the freezer, take a home cooler, a foam cooler, and throw a little square of cardboard over the top, and then a block of dry ice, which you could get at most supermarkets.
Yes, you can. At least here in Atlanta, you can. Yeah.
In your home ice cream, then, if you make it in a, you know, if you buy an old churn that you can make a gallon of, it might be worth your while to make ice cream at home, and I think you could accomplish something maybe even better than what we make.
Did you guys used to have like a guy in a top hat deliver your ice cream?
We did.
Is that right? And he would show up in a top hat and say, I'm here to deliver the best ice cream in the world.
That's true.
Do you still do that?
Well, Roy is about 67 years old.
That's so the guy. I've seen his picture online.
Yeah, he's amazing. He lives in the neighborhood here.
How did you decide to do that?
Roy was my neighbor. So okay. Roy called me up and he said, Keith, I understand you're opening a company. I said, yes. And he said, an ice cream company. I said, yes, sir. And he said, you know, it's been my dream since I was a little boy to drive an ice cream truck. And I said,
okay, that could be creepy.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It felt a little, right? And I said,
okay, Roy, okay. I got to go now.
That was my initial
That's
reaction.
Nice, Roy.
So he said, can I drive your truck? I said, yes, absolutely. So he went and he started delivering High Road around the city.
And did you have an ice cream truck at the time?
We had a delivery truck.
Okay, but do you have an ice cream truck?
No, sir.
Why not?
It's coming.
Why in this age of food truck does you know, in the food truck thing, why does High Road not have an ice cream truck? You need an ice cream truck.
I don't know. We were worried that it would make us lose focus, where we'd be out, you know, selling one scoop at a time instead of focusing on the chefs.
Marketing.
I know.
All right. So Roy, I don't have a truck. So Roy the elderly neighbor.
So Roy goes out in a t-shirt and jeans the first few times to deliver the ice cream. Now, Roy is very like flamboyant, high energy, very expressive fella. And he comes back and he said, "Keith." I said, "Yes, Roy." He said, "People love your ice cream." And I said, "That's great.
That means
we'll probably have deliveries tomorrow." He goes, "No, they love your ice cream." I said, "Okay." He goes, "Can you wait here for a minute?" And I said, "Sure." He goes, "I've got an idea." And I, now, mind you, I have all these chef types with the tattoos.
Right,
and the
ink,
you know,
all over. And the attitude.
Yeah,
we all know attitude, the chef attitude,
dudes. Sure. So Roy comes out of the restroom in a full-on tux, tails, and top hat with a name tag that says High Road Roy on it. And we all look at each other like our brand is ruined forever. We're doomed. And I just took a deep breath and I was like, okay, well, we have these deliveries to go. And Roy goes out and he becomes a phenomenon around town. Chefs and dishwashers are taking their pictures with him, putting it on Twitter. And Roy becomes this ambassador for High Road.
And where's Roy now?
Roy's resting because we tore up his shoulder real bad. So he had surgery. But, you know, he doesn't want to age. You know, he wants to stay young and involved. And I think maybe we have to get an ice cream truck for Mr. Roy.
What's next? Where do you see this in a year, 5 years, 10 years?
I think in a year there's going to be some significant interest in the Bangkok area. We've got we're focusing a little bit more on marketing. We see ourselves more as a brand now. There's some talk of television with us right now, and I think there are additional products that we can address. There are talks of muffin mixes and caramels and baking mixes and other things other things that haven't been elevated. We don't want to have 400 flavors of ice cream. We'd rather have, you know, 30 flavors of ice cream that come and go like the breeze. And when they need to be discontinued and refreshed, we'll come back like Madonna.
Hey, tell me about the book.
I was at an event called Food Blog South 2 years ago.
Right. I've never been, but I get to send people there that go and enjoy themselves and run up big bills and then come back and tell me nothing.
It's a fun event. So, and we love to support that. I mean, those are the folks who put us on the map, the food bloggers. So we went and was with a salesperson of ours and pointed me out to a food editor for Oxmoor House and said, our owner here is a great writer. And so I met this woman, Sean Chavis, and she came up and she said, I hear you write well. I said, I don't know. Let you be the judge of that. And she said, well, I have a frozen desserts cookbook coming up. Why don't you throw your hat into the ring? So I threw my hat into the ring for the frozen desserts cookbook. And she called back and she said, you didn't tell me you were a chef. And I said, You didn't ask. You said, write a proposal.
Yeah, because she's so used to people telling that right up front. I'm a chef.
Right.
Yeah.
So I said nothing. And so it came. She asked for a small bio in the proposal. And I wrote, you know, some recipes in a unique format and where I addressed the why I added this and why I did that. And that just came from my years as a teacher, enjoying people like yourself asking why I was getting
why.
So I felt like it was important for me to have those answers and I wanted to roll it into a book. She said, well, we have a food science series that we've been thinking of and I've turned away a number of writers, but you're the guy. And I said, great. And again, I'm a total novice in the publishing world. I didn't know anything about anything other than I think I know what you want. I think I know how to write in the voice that you're looking for. And so here I am writing a book series, two books, one on baking, one on cooking called Mad Delicious.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Good luck with that. I hope I get inaugural copies.
Absolutely.
Last question. Why High Road?
So I was working for a hotel company. I was sitting in my car one day after my hotel company and my culinary team had achieved record profitability in the middle of the economic downturn. And so after I get my report, you're number one, you guys are the best, thank you so much. Follow-up email like 47 seconds later was, we're cutting your staff further. And being a hotel chef who started back in the late 80s, early 90s, that hotel kitchen used to be packed with people. There were 50 people. There was a saucier and there was a bakery kitchen. And I had been whittled down to 12 folks to service an entire hotel full of people. And the places that used to have cooks now had boxes and box cutters and frozen hors d'oeuvres because you just simply could not afford to cook anymore. And so it felt so...
Could not afford to cook anymore.
Right? Soulless. It was a soulless experience. So I got in my car and I said, I think I'm in the real estate business, not the hospitality business anymore. This sucks. I have to find a way to take the high road because I was getting like... Chef angry.
Yeah, you know, like chef rage.
I want to throw something.
Yeah. I knew it would probably be something sharp.
Right. So at the same time, I said, I want to take the high road. The song from the Broken Bells, The High Road, came on my radio in my car. And I was like, this is a sign.
You shouldn't have said that because now you're going to have to pay him rights.
Sorry.
That's what the ice cream truck can play.
Right.
You've got it. All right, Keith Schroeder, thanks for joining us from High Road Ice Cream, and thanks for bringing the ice cream. I've consumed probably 7,000 calories of it, and I'm going to go get on the treadmill.
Thanks for your time.
You bet. All right, let's go to the phones and take a question. Jay, are you there?
I am here.
Where are you, Jay?
I am calling from beautiful downtown Gloucester, Virginia.
All right, what can I do for you, Jay?
Well, I've really kind of gotten into the approach of science to food, and that's why I watched a lot of your Good Eats episodes. Recently, due to some health issues, I've gone completely vegan. And I don't see anything that kind of approaches that in any past programs, and I was just curious if you were heading anywhere in that direction in the future.
We haven't approached it as a lifestyle because, to me, I like to think of myself as a flexitarian and an omnivore. I don't eat meat every day. I don't eat animal products every day. To me, they're just one of a wide, you know, kind of variety of foods. So what we've done in the past is we've just always treated vegetables as, you know, and well, not just vegetables, but, you know, vegan foods as just great foods. Our thing being that there's only two kinds of food, good food and bad food. As far as trying to look for, you know, dietary replacements of saying, okay, we're now going to live that lifestyle and we're not going to have meat or animal products anymore. We've never broached that because it's just not the way I live. I wouldn't mind, maybe living that way for a while, and there would be a lot of benefits to it. I'm sure I would have an easier time losing weight if I was strictly a vegan. But by the same token, I'm highly skeptical of diets that are extremely high in certain grains. So, you know, to me, I'm one of those guys that I rather cover my bets like I'm playing roulette. I rather bet on a whole bunch of food than becoming singular on just a very, very few things. So we haven't done that. But as interest grows, and there are more and more people like you who are realizing that they can take their health into their own hands by making dietary changes, we're probably going to have to adapt and start kind of taking that approach.
Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome. Good luck. And hey, listen, congratulations on your big health change.
Thanks, buddy. Will do.
All right, take care. All right, we have another caller who's decided to squander some perfectly good time by making contact with me here at the Alton Browncast. And it's a she named Robbie. Robbie, hi.
Hi, Alton. How are you?
I'm all right. Where are you?
I'm in Washington, D.C.
What can I do for you?
Well, I do have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so early on in Good Eats, Season 1, Episode 7, we saw you take on your grandmother, the formidable Ma May.
Yes.
The biscuit recipe.
Yes, ma'am.
And you later went on to revise it with your healthier biscuit recipe.
I did.
And I was just wondering, is there any recipe that you consider too perfect, too sacred, too well researched to touch, regardless of whatever claims technology or methodology may have to improve upon what you've already done?
I think that there are things that shouldn't be messed with. I absolutely believe not every recipe needs improving. Not every recipe needs to be cleaned up or made healthy. And I think that for somebody like me, coming up with a healthier biscuit was simply an effort to try to get into a position where I could eat biscuits more often. You know, I think that was probably because I want biscuits. And I can't seem to help that.
Butter and jam.
Yeah, there. You know, give me bread and fat and a little bit of sweetness, especially in the morning, and I'm there. But I think that once a recipe has meaning that it's gone beyond, you know, it's like what you were talking about. You know, when you've got a family recipe where the actual making of that food has intrinsic value or it means something, then it shouldn't be messed with. You just shouldn't. I tinker with biscuits because biscuits are so. I'm Southern. They need to be tinkered with. But I end up always going back to where I started, which is typically my grandmother's. Thanks, Robbie, in Washington, D.C., for getting in touch.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Bye. Continuing on the Alton Browncast, I'm going to read a couple of questions that have come in from our email bag from askalton@altonbrown.com. Jennifer Gross sends this also via askalton@altonbrown.com. What should I look for when shopping for a cast iron skillet? Do I have to spend a lot of money? Are there specific brands that you would recommend? I know seasoning and time is key, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to worry about the rest of that. Okay, here's the thing. As far as I'm concerned, there's two brands of cast iron in the United States. One is no longer made, and I consider them to be heirloom pieces, and that would be Griswold. Griswold has made a zillion different cast iron pieces for well over 100 years. They haven't made them now since, I think, I don't know. Let me see if I get Patty Catalano, my researcher, to find out when Griswold stopped making cast iron here in America. But they've become big collector's items, and there's still a lot of them to be found in secondhand stores and antique shops, and they're as good as the day they were made. You may have to recure them, but that's easily done. So keep your eye open for Griswold. That's hardcore stuff, and excellent, excellent iron. The only company that's making good cast iron in America today, I know there are a couple of mom and pops, but they're hard to get. But the Lodge Corporation of South Pittsburgh, Tennessee, is making really, really good cast iron. It's a family-owned business, and they've 1957. So Griswold shut down in 1957, but the stuff is still out there and in very unusual shape pieces. I definitely suggest you get that. If you're buying new, buy Lodge. Very good metallurgy, great casting processes, and a good product. And almost all of their product now is pre-cured in oil before they ship them, so you don't have to go through that whole curing process. But let's see, Jennifer goes on to say, I know the seasoning of time is key, but I'm not one of those fortunate people who has had one passed down from a relative. Just follow the instructions. You can even Google my name, Alton Brown Cast Iron, on the internet and come up with the entire curing process. And we're actually going to be doing a webisode about that for my new YouTube channel here very, very shortly. Just remember Griswold and Lodge, you'll be fine. All right, here's a question that I want to address. This also came in through Ask Alton at AltonBrown.com. This is from Kevin Tibbs. He says, I was Oscar the Grouch for Halloween, and now I have a new metal trash can with the bottom removed. Any suggestions on what I can use for it? I was thinking it could be the body for a smoker, but I'm worried that the volume would be a bit large, and also wonder if the galvanized steel would be too thermally conductive to bring the food to cooking temperatures. Opinions. Okay, Kevin, listen, this is important. You cannot cook with galvanized steel. Okay. Galvanized steel, when it gets hot, gives out some very, very nasty fumes. I think there's a, I'm trying to remember what the worst of it is. I think it's got to do with the zinc that is placed in galvanized steel, and it's toxic. Don't do it. Basically, I can't think of anything you can do with that can other than make an obstacle for your dog to run through, as long as the edges aren't sharp, or you know, turn it into a planter. But don't smoke in it. Do not do that, Kevin. Do you hear me? Promise me. Promise me. Okay. All right, listeners, that's it for today's episode, or edition, if you will, of the Alton Brown Cast. Thanks for being with us today. We will be back soon with another episode. Fascinating personalities being interviewed, your questions, food stories, and whatnot. And until then, America, cook smart.